From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, we're talking about quackery, snake oil, miracle cures, the weirdest and really the worst ways we've tried to cure ourselves or live longer lives. And there's been a lot of this stuff over time. Some of it's crazy, some of it's creepy, like blood jam. The physician Lydia Kang has a book where she takes us through some of this quackery and why we not only need to be saved from quacks, but from ourselves. We'll be right back. We have a new short doc at Radio West Films you should go check out. It comes from San Juan County, where it's tough to keep teachers at the Native American schools there. The tribes in the region may have figured out a solution because consistency matters to these kids. And once a student gives a teacher their trust, they want to know if you'll be back next year. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Lydia Kang and Nate Peterson have a book that they describe as a brief history of the worst ways to cure everything. It's about snake oil and quack remedies and miracle cures. A lot of this stuff is preposterous looking at it now, like bird poop potions and goat testicle transplants, tapeworms for weight loss, leeches for bloodletting. But at the time, because they didn't really know how the body worked or how to cure a disease, people were willing to try anything, and there was always someone around to take advantage of it. One of the questions they ask in the book is whether scientific discoveries or government regulations has cured us of quackery. The answer is of course not, because Lydia Kang says behind all of this stuff is the human inclination to survive. The book is called Quackery. Lydia Kang is a practicing physician, writer, and poet. She joined us yesterday from a studio in Omaha, Nebraska. Let's begin with what got you started. Like, as a physician, did it represent an ongoing kind of concern of yours or gripe of yours? I mean, one of the things I've heard you say is that, let's be honest, we don't often go to the physician as the first thing. Like, we often go last. It's a last resort sort of thing.
Right.
So I'm wondering, did this represent something that you had seen as a physician and worried about?
Well, we knew that there's so much controversy currently about, a whole host of different treatments that I see personally in my practice and my colleagues will talk about. And I see things pop up on my computer and I see things on television and I hear radio ads and it gets frustrating. When we knew we were going to talk about and write this book, it was a chance to go back in time and see where some of these ideas came from that still exist today and, you know, kind of investigate why did they die out? Why can we look back and laugh at some of these things and yet some of the things we don't laugh at?
Yeah.
So that was a unique opportunity, I think, to sort of take some of the current stuff, look backwards. But one thing that I wanted very much for the book to do is I wanted universally anybody to be able to read it and laugh at it and look back and see how far we've come. And so we did make a very conscious choice to do a history, to go into things that were so outlandish that anybody could pick up the book, no matter what their viewpoints on medical care now, and be able to laugh at it. So we did spend a good amount of time going to the past, but we tried to tie a lot of these things into current day.
Yeah.
To let people know, yeah, some of these things haven't actually died off.
Right, right.
And some of these things, as outlandish as they may see, you know, things like arsenic and using leeches, there is actually a place for that today in contemporary medicine. So it was kind of this good sort of back and forth we were able to do.
You say in the book that quackery is not always about pure deception. Explain what you mean. I mean, I guess in a lot of these, now there were plenty of charlatans in your book, of course, but there was also a lot of good intentions in there too.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I struggled with that. And I even struggled with, Nate and I talked a lot about the title of the book because we didn't want to necessarily say, hey, look back at Hippocrates. He was a complete charlatan. And what was he thinking? Because at the time, there are so many practitioners who were doing what they thought was the best thing for people. And there's no quackery in that. So we did, you know, sort of have to take several different perspectives. There's sort of the purest kind of form of quackery where you have people fooling the public, selling them things that aren't real to make a buck.
Yeah.
And then there's also this sort of idea of things that we now would call quackery if we were to say, hey, why don't you take some arsenic pills?
Yeah.
No one would be okay with that, you know,
yeah,
for treating, you know, bad complexion or something like that. So so we did kind of play around with the concept that there's a lot of stuff in here that we today would call quack medicine that we would today would say is completely ridiculous, but doesn't always center around that perfect definition of quackery.
Here's something you write early in the book, and I think this gets at if there's a if there's an underlying theme or a common denominator for all of this, it's this. You say, behind every misguided treatment is the incredible power of the human desire to live. And not only live, but you also get at this the fact that we want health. We want eternal youth. We want virility. So so this is as much us and the way we can be easily manipulated because of our ego or just our simple unease about, you know, immortality or mortality. And that's where this, as you put it, this is where quackery seems to thrive.
I think it absolutely does. And I, you know, I take that all very personally because as, you know, a woman in her 40s whose joints are starting to get a little creaky,
right,
whose, you know, wrinkles are starting to show up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very interesting perspective to be able to see yourself age, see what you used to have, and want to cling so hard to it. I see that in my patients. I see that in my family members and my friends. And that is very much alive, and it's never going to go away. So to be able to look back and see that the human, you know, humans have been just remarkable in their deep desire to cling to youth, mm-hmm, and to cling to beauty or to desire beauty, and to want the impossible in some cases, such as immortality. So being able to look through that, through the perspectives of, you know, different practitioners, different patients, and these really strange treatments and elements was a way to kind of actually think about ourselves in a lot of ways.
One of the things you point out is it kind of goes back to, I guess, this sort of positive twist on all of this. And that is, it's this kind of quackery has also driven innovation. And that seems to be pretty interesting because it seems like there's this give and take that you write about. We need, as you say, a more complicated or complete understanding of how the human body functions. So you can battle charlatans on one hand. But then you also say we need to keep open minds about ways to combat disease and improve longevity. So on one hand, yes, be skeptical, but not so skeptical that we, what, miss out on something valuable, I guess.
Yeah, we definitely should not settle for this is good enough. And I don't think we ever will. Everyone's always trying to look for the next best thing and, you know, a better treatment. But therein lies an issue because you can, you know, be faced with opportunities that are actually dangerous before they're well thought out and well studied. But at the same time, you need that because you need that for medical research. You need that to inspire people to come up with great ideas. And a lot of the treatments that we talk about in the book were toxic and dangerous and awful, but, you know, some of these things ended up being, when looked at more rigorously, you know, under the microscope, it was found that they were actually quite useful. So that sort of push and pull of wanting the next best latest thing, but also finding those gems and jewels within them that are really useful, is this balance that you see in the book, but is just very much alive today.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure even where to start, but let's just start at the beginning. It's as good as any. You begin with this story about Pink's disease.
Yes.
And how in the 1920s, all of a sudden people are seeing more and more of this Pink's disease. Now, explain what it is and what's going on here.
So Pink's disease was this disease described by physicians in the late 1800s, but more so in the early 1900s. These children were complaining of having these icy, well, maybe not complaining, they were probably just screaming their heads off for the most part. But the parents were noticing these babies and toddlers were having fevers, these terribly petulant moods, icy, swollen hands and fingers that would get red and peel, almost crack. The children would lose weight. They would have intense itching, and so they'd almost be clawing their skin off. And parents and physicians had no idea what the cause was. They just knew it was cropping up. They called it Pink's disease. And it seemed to only affect babies and toddlers.
And it took them forever to figure out what was going on. It turns out it was calomel.
Yes.
Explain what calomel is, because this gets us to mercury.
Yeah, so calomel is a mercury salt. It's mercurous chloride, and it was a really common medicine used for centuries. It was used for all sorts of things. It was used for syphilis. It was, in this case, used for teething. And so you could buy these little teething powders if your little one was complaining and salivating a lot and maybe not sleeping very well, and you thought, ah, baby's teething. Let's go get some medicine and rub some powder into, you know, his or her gums and see how the baby does. And unfortunately, a lot of these powders, sometimes they contain things like cocaine, sometimes they had opium, but a lot of times they had calomel. One of the side effects of calomel is it makes you salivate more, but it might also make you have some diarrhea. But it was considered a very mainstay treatment. Calomel treated everything, and so they thought it would help with the teething as well. But as almost everybody knows today, mercury is incredibly dangerous and toxic. And in the salt form like this, you absorb it and it can cause these terrible toxicities. And Pink's disease was one of them.
This calomel is interesting. It was it's the idea, and this seems to come up a lot in the history of some quackery, this urge to and this inclination to want to get patients to purge, to vomit or defecate, that somehow this was healing. And calomel seemed like one of these things. You mentioned this this doctor, Benjamin Rush, a physician who prescribed calomel all the time. In fact, he prescribed it to Lewis and Clark on their expedition. They took, was it, like 600 of these pills on their expedition with them?
Yes, yeah. They were fondly known as thunderbolts for their effect on the privy.
Right.
So, yes, calomel. Benjamin Rush, who's one of our founding fathers and one of our, you know, founding fathers in medicine, not just, you know, as far as the Constitution goes, but, you know, he really believed that purging was a fantastic way to get the body to sort of right itself. And that idea in the late 1700s was born from an idea that came from a long, long, long time ago. So in the time of Hippocrates, there was this concept of the humors. So, you know, everybody right now who has a pretty decent understanding that, you know, you breathe air and oxygen goes through your lungs into your blood vessels and that your heart pumps your blood vessels and your brain's used for thinking through things. I mean, that is a level of physiology understanding that people did not have 1,000 years ago. Stuff that you learn in third grade.
Right.
So back then they thought that the human body worked because of this balance of four humors, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood. And if one of these humors was out of balance, that would cause disease. So the way that you would get things better is you bring, you would purge if one of those humors was overbalanced. So classically, for example, like black bile, if it was causing too many problems, you took something that made you have, you know, explosive diarrhea.
Yeah.
And if you sort of make things run a little bit too fast, sometimes your bile actually exits out. You see some blackness in the stools and people say, ah, we are balancing the black bile. Now, calomel was a classic medicine to make this happen. It was a cathartic and it would violently make you just lose everything in your intestines out the other end. It was pretty harsh. However, people like that. You know, they thought if something's working, if they can see the change in their body and it's affecting their body, then it must be doing something. And that is a concept that we see over and over again in the book. You know, a lot of people would ask, why would they do these things to themselves? Well, it's because they knew it did something.
Yeah.
And so they believed that it helped. And
yeah,
in some
something
cases,
was happening, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Earthquakes.
Yes.
Something was happening.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's interesting. I'm trying to imagine how many people, I mean, it's impossible to know, of course, but died from mercury poisoning. I mean, it's hard to imagine. You mentioned Abraham Lincoln was the victim of mercury poisoning, probably.
Yeah, there are a lot of theories that Abraham Lincoln did take mercury. He took specifically a pill called Blue Mass. So Blue Mass was a compounded pill that was made from actually elemental mercury. So that silver, quicksilver stuff that is in people's thermometers that you probably played with when you were a kid.
Yeah, I did.
So did I.
Yeah.
And so what they would do is they would take that elemental mercury and the pharmacist or the apothecary would pound it, like just pound the crap out of it. And that was a process called extinction, where those, you know, silvery beads mm-hmm. would get made into smaller and smaller and smaller beads to the point where they could be mixed in with these other you know, herbs and things like that into a pill. And it was called Blue Mass. And Abraham Lincoln took it because he had what were called bilious headaches. They were headaches, but blamed on a little bit too much bile in the body. And so, again, what better way to get rid of bile than to take mercury? So he took them, but there's, you know, some theory that they caused him to have a lot of side effects of mercury poisoning that included depression and moodiness, and apparently there's some idea that he might have stopped taking it before he actually entered the White House, which was probably good as far as the Civil War is concerned, but having an overly moody president is not a good thing.
No, it's not. That's right. I loved one of the chapter headings here, as long as we're talking about purging, A Brief History of Hurling. Emetics, I guess. Is that how it's pronounced? Emetics?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this all links back to that idea of humors in the body. Talk about who Oliver Goldsmith was. Poor fellow.
Yeah. So Oliver Goldsmith, I first heard about him in high school when I read She Stoops to Conquer. And I really enjoyed the play. Thought it was great. But apparently other people did not think so great of him. Horace Walpole called him an inspired idiot, which is not terribly nice. But before he became a writer, he dabbled in medicine, didn't quite get his degree. But he got sick. And everybody knew at the time that, you know, one way to get rid of, you know, feeling ill was to use a cathartic of some sort, either from one end or the other end, mm-hmm. vomiting.
Yeah.
So he asked his pharmacist to prescribe him St. James's fever powder. And it was very famous at the time. People used it all the time for anything, gout, scurvy, whatever.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, he really wanted this. So he took it and it made him throw up pretty incessantly, probably to the point of running him into kidney failure.
Right.
He was having convulsions and vomiting and more convulsions. And about 18 hours after he started taking St. James's fever powder, Oliver Goldsmith died.
Yeah. These emetics are so interesting because the Romans loved to purge. Would you talk a little bit about this? I had no idea that during feasts they would find these emetics and they would so they could just eat more, throw it up and eat more and throw it up and eat more.
Yeah, I think I probably heard this when I was a teenager too, that, you know, people would throw up, just eat to the point where they were full, but they enjoyed eating so much that they would throw up and do it all over again. And there's actually some, you know, some writing about Seneca the Younger, who's the counsel to Emperor Nero, mentioned that some Romans liked to, quote, vomit to eat and ate to vomit, and they didn't really care about actually digesting their food. And I remember hearing when I was a teenager that there were these like vomitoriums that people would use to throw up so that they could eat. But I didn't find out until I did the research of the book that I was that that's an incorrect usage of the word. It turns out that a vomitorium is an exit area of the amphitheater so that people can purge and leave the building. It actually had nothing to do with throwing up. So there was something that I didn't realize that I'd learned from there. But it all came down to, you know, the history of vomiting, apparently.
That's Lydia Kang, along with Nate Peterson. She's co-author of the book Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about quackery. The physician Lydia Kang takes us through some of this quackery over time and why we not only need to be saved from quacks, but from ourselves. Her book is called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. Let's talk about arsenic. This was really fascinating, too. Your chapter begins with the story of Mary Frances Creighton. Explain who she is. She poisoned the chocolate pudding, basically.
She did. So Mary Frances Creighton is one of the most famous serial killers of all time. They used to call her the Long Island Borgia. So, you know, for anybody who knows their history about the Medici and the Borgia, they were very famous in Europe for using arsenic to kill off whoever was in the way. People would say things like, there was a famous saying that no Roman ever said, "I dined last night with the Borgias," because they were too dead to say so. So that's how she got her nickname. But she had killed off probably her mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And then her brother came to live with her. And after getting a life insurance policy on him, started feeding him pudding every night, this chocolate pudding that her brother noted, like, you know, even when I didn't want to eat the chocolate pudding, she kept pushing the chocolate pudding on me, which is probably something everybody should be cautious of. If someone's forcing you to eat something every night, probably not a good idea. I should check the contents of said pudding. But anyway, he was doing this, and he started to get really sick, and he died. And when they started doing some investigating, they realized that he died from arsenic poisoning. Now, the interesting thing was that it wasn't really clear that Mary Frances Creighton was the killer, because everybody had arsenic in the house.
Exactly.
There was this treatment, this medicine called Fowler's Solution, which had arsenic, and people had it in their, you know, their medicine cupboards all the time. They used it to beautify themselves. If they used it to take care of skin ailments, or if they were having heartburn, they would take some Fowler's Solution. So, you know, there was a question of, did he actually get poisoned, or was this an accidental poisoning? But eventually it was found out that she was the killer, and she went to Sing Sing and died in the electric chair, apparently.
You write this in the book: there were plenty of ladies willing to eat poison and unwillingly die for beauty. What did arsenic do for you cosmetically? Because you say there was a big arsenic cosmetic fad for a time.
There was. Even back to ancient times, people recognized that arsenic did cause your hair to fall off. So it was, I'm probably pronouncing this wrong, a depilatory, but it made your hair fall off. So people did use it for that. But in addition, some people thought that using arsenic either topically or by ingesting it, it would make your skin pale and clear, rosy in some cases. And it had a little bit of some truth to that. Arsenic did cause some cause your capillaries to sort of get a little bit bigger and dilate, so it might give you some rosy cheeks. But the interesting thing is that it over time, it actually makes your skin turn browner and thicker, so it wasn't actually that good for your beauty. But a lot of this came down to some, you know, stories that people had heard of these, you know, beautiful young ladies who were eating arsenic, and oh, they were gorgeous. And it was actually from a medical paper that happened in the 1800s that people said there are these arsenic eaters and these beautiful young ladies who ate it. And that's part of where those rumors kind of came from. But, you know, one of the most famous ladies who took arsenic to keep herself young and gorgeous, Kate Brewington Bennett, she died in St. Louis from eating too much arsenic, unfortunately, even though she was hoping it was going to keep her young looking forever. It didn't keep her alive forever.
Yeah. Gold is another really interesting. I hadn't realized that the idea of ingesting gold would be some sort of cure-all. And another great character in the book is Leslie Keeley, this Union Army surgeon who, I guess he promised to cure alcoholism with gold.
He did. You know, it's funny because you say it's like kind of a weird idea to eat gold for medicine, but if I try to sort of imagine as a child, like some sort of magical thing that I could take that would make me better, gold seems like it would be really fitting. I mean,
true.
Gold's, it's beautiful, it's precious. And people recognized, you know, since ancient times that gold doesn't tarnish. It's rare, it's beautiful, it's ductile. You can, you know, turn it into things. And it looks like the sun. And so from a sort of magical point of view, you could see how people really look to it as a possible cure-all for things. And gold is, it's flashy and it sells really well.
Yeah.
And I think Dr. Keeley kept that in mind. So he came up with this gold cure, which was a combination of injections and this tonic that you would drink to cure alcoholism. I mean, the great thing about Dr. Keeley is that he recognized that alcoholism was a disease, not a moral failing, which is a huge step in the right direction. But unfortunately, he also said, hey, if you drink my gold tonics and take my gold pills and come to my, you know, my detox centers that popped up all over the United States. I mean, I think if you do a little research into your own town and city, you'll find that there was a Keeley Institute there. So people lined up for these and they stopped drinking for a couple of weeks, and then they went home sober. Did they stay sober? Most likely not. Did the treatment actually work? Well, let's take a closer look at what was actually in the treatments.
Right. Because it's just making them more stoned and drunk and whatever.
Yeah. They were chock full of morphine and cannabis and cocaine and strychnine and alcohol. There was alcohol in the alcohol treatment medicine.
Yeah.
So no wonder they weren't having withdrawal symptoms because they were too doped up to care. But was there actually gold in there? Probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime someone asked Dr. Keeley, hey, can we get a bottle of this so we can actually see if there's really gold in this? He would sort of say, sure, take this bottle and hand a bottle over. But people who would secretly grab one of his tonics and measure it would find no gold in it at all. So, you know, he knew that that gold sold really well, you know, shiny, pretty, and it sounds really good, the gold cure. And it worked for a while, made him a very rich man for a little while, but he ended up dying and keeping the recipe for the actual treatment, you know, to his grave. So the people who inherited his estate never actually knew the true ingredients. So who knows if he actually did put a spot of gold in here that was like infinitesimally small, but I don't believe he did.
The tobacco section was really interesting. And I was really drawn to one of the headings here, blowing smoke up your arse. when it turns out blowing smoke up someone's butt was the sanctioned resuscitation method in the 18th century.
Yes, it was. If you lived on near the Thames, you might see these signs and these little kits that were there to help people resuscitate victims of drowning. There was actually this
And these kids, I should say, came with bellows. They had these bellows in them.
They did. And thank goodness for the bellows, because if you actually had to do the blowing directly someone's back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, just you think of like the dysentery and like the cholera that was going around. Yeah. It was like, yes, please hand me the bellows. The bellows is far cleaner. But there was this, you know, this fantastic society that was formed to help put these kits out. And it was called, I did not make this up, the Institution for Affording Immediate Relief to Persons Apparently Dead from Drowning.
Right.
And they made sure that these kits were available, and you would strike up, this little pot of smoke and use the bellows, and you would blow smoke into someone's rear end. And, if they weren't dead, most likely that would give them quite a shock and wake them up.
But what was the weird logic behind? I mean, surely there was some kind of logic to it, right?
Well, you know, probably the warmth of the smoke might help them feel better if they were cold, if they were chilled. And, you know, there was also this kind of idea that smoke was a way of sort of making people feel better. Tobacco at the time was being kind of investigated as ways to, clean things and, kill diseases and germs and things like that. So I think it was an idea that kind of made sense, but they didn't really think it through and realized it wasn't actually working. Yeah. So it didn't last for very long.
Yeah. Well, I happen to know that your favorite section is the cannibalism section. So let's go into that. The corpse medicine. So I guess let's start with the story that you tell right at the top of this chapter. You write about, this was in 1758, and these young men, and young is the operative idea here. This is really important. These young men were going to be hanged. And so around this time, people would just kind of wait around for this to happen, to tell the story.
Right. So the year was 1758. And it was a pretty common thing at that time to go to executions for entertainment purposes. I mean, I think everybody's probably watched a movie where they saw it happening and, Braveheart and all that. But, hangings were a great way for, people to remind themselves not to commit crimes, but it was also entertainment. But it was also therapeutic. So in this issue of Gentleman's Magazine, they actually discussed how at the end of this hanging, a child who was pretty young, about 9 months old, was put into the hands of the executioner and 9 times touched the child's face with the hands of the dead bodies. I know, it's pretty gruesome and macabre and, why would they do such a thing? The child suffered from probably boils or warts or something like that on their skin, and it was a common idea that if you rubbed, a dead body on a skin affliction, you could cure it. So pretty grotesque for us, pretty normal for them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Corpse medicine was not nearly as disgusting back then as we considered it today.
So you write this, some of the greatest standard bearers of medicine fit into their philosophies this idea of consuming pieces of dead humans.
Yes. Yeah. And, it comes from the same idea of, what people were doing at these hangings. It's this idea, again, a sort of a magical idea that the human body has this sort of vitality, this vital force. And maybe you can get it if you consume it or if you touch it. Ideally, you want that vital force to be as vital as possible, meaning, hopefully you're getting your source from someone who's young, someone who's male, because women were considered, the weaker sex. So you wanted someone young, male, and who hadn't been suffering from a long-term illness, so they had to be healthy. And you wanted that force to be had at the peak of its energy, so nothing was sort of kind of trickling away at the time. So ideally, these bodies, these people, victims, would be dying in a very violent manner. Mm-hmm. So as to kind of save all their vital energy best as possible, right? So who better, where better to find, somebody who's young, male, killed violently than at a hanging or an execution? Right. So this was one of the places where people like to go, you know, find these sources. And gladiators were another kind of a place to do that. You know, fallen gladiator, and people would run up to them with cups and try to drink their spilled blood or eat some of their liver and that sort of a thing.
There's this really gross story from Pope Innocent VIII, who was apparently a horrible guy.
He was terrible.
Yeah, he was terrible. This was 1492, and he basically bribed three young boys to give him some of their blood, and they basically bled out. They died, and of course, so did he.
Right, right. So this is the story. You know, I don't know if we fully know if it's 100% true, but it might have actually been a rumor spread to smear the doctor who actually made this all happen. But apparently, yeah, he was not feeling well, so he bribed three young boys with a gold coin and bled them. And apparently the boys died, and the Pope drank the blood. He died. It just didn't go well for anybody.
No. Well, you have a recipe in the book for blood jam.
Yummy.
Yeah, yummy. Let's talk about what this is, because this blood jam is a thing. This was probably the 16th, 17th century?
Yeah. This was a 1679 recipe from a Franciscan apothecary. And it was the idea that, you know, maybe some people don't find eating, you know, fresh blood to be very palatable, so you could turn it into jam instead. You know, we try to summarize the recipe in the book. But you basically, you know, you let, in case anybody wants this out here, you can bookmark this for
here
the
it
next
is.
Time. You let the blood dry into a sticky mass, and then you cut it into slices and let the watery part drip away, and then you stir it into a batter on the stove with a knife, and you pound it through a sieve of the finest silk,
nice.
And then seal it in a jar. It didn't say afterwards what you're supposed to do with it. Like, do you spread it on toast or
right.
crackers? You just, like, spoon it, like, Nutella style, like, with the spoon? I don't know. But they did say, you know, like all recipes, it's sort of like find the best ingredients. They did mention you should have somebody with a blotchy red complexion. That's where you should get your blood from, because not only young male are the sort of key ingredients to, you know, a lot of this corpse and cannibalistic medicine, but redheads had that, you know, sadly throughout time, redheads have been considered, you know, magical, evil, all sorts of horrible things. Redheads were considered to have more of this sort of vital force. And so if you could find a, you know, Ron Weasley, you'd be in good shape.
There's a recipe for redheaded cadavers from the early 1600s, which gets us to man's grease. Talk about what man's grease is, because this is pretty gross.
You can actually Google this. Like, I think if you go to like eBay or Google, you can find these old apothecary jars for oil, human oil and fat. It's like axung hominis. Ours is usually written on the apothecary jars. But this was a salve that people would use to rub into their skin to, they would use it for pain relief and achy joints and love potions and things like that. But, you know, that executioner who was like holding the baby and rubbing the baby all over the dead men, they would also be tasked with the job of processing some of these dead bodies. So they would oftentimes, you know, render the fat off of these corpses and put them in jars and sell it as, you know, as a salve. They would call it like man's grease or poor sinner's fat, which is really sad. But this oil of human fat was used for all sorts of things, and it was a common treatment.
I want to come to the section of the book where you could almost imagine these ideas, and in fact, it's probably true, that being part of a modern thinking in terms of natural cures, because there's a whole section of these. There's fasting and detoxing and cold water cure. Let's start with cold water cures, because I think this is really interesting, and it leads us to another great character, Vincennes, is it Prischnitz?
Prischnitz? I think it's it, yeah.
Something like that, whom you describe in the book as an Austrian badass.
Yeah,
talk about this guy. This is pretty great.
So he was this 18-year-old kid who, you know, unfortunately, he he got into this accident with a horse, and it knocked out his front teeth, and he got rolled over by the cart that the horse was attached to, and he had all these broken ribs, and, you know, this is a guy who back then probably could have died from his illnesses, from his wounds. But he decided what he would do was lean over a wooden chair and set his ribs back into place, hence the whole badass thing.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's pretty painful.
Yeah. And on top of that, he remembered this time that he saw this this deer go into a stream several times to bathe a wound. And he thought, you know what, I'm going to do that because maybe this would actually help me heal better. Mm-hmm. And it did. He got better right away, and he dubbed this the cold water cure. And it actually did make a lot of sense. I mean, if you have a wound and you cleanse it,
clean it,
rather than leaving it dirty,
that
might actually be a good thing. Drinking cold water on a regular basis, not a bad idea. So, you know, staying well hydrated and having clean wounds, brilliant idea.
I know. That is the thing. This comes up time and time again where you have, I have to say, these kind of quack ideas are just improvisations on kind of common sense.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. And it's funny how, you know, things will flip around. Like even when it comes to wounds, like we think, okay, keep wounds clean, and, you know, God forbid you have like bugs crawling on the wound. But, you know, we found out from trial and error that actually maggots clean some dirty wounds incredibly well, better than a surgeon's knife, you know, debriding like dead skin and stuff like that. And, you know, that came from a wound that wasn't clean. So it's just, you could go in either direction and see how these, you know, great ideas come about that seem maybe at the time horrible, even in today's mind. You know, if someone says, oh my gosh, you have a wound that's covered in maggots, and it's, you know what, actually it's a real treatment that is used. If you had a bad wound, your doctor might prescribe maggot therapy today.
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
So you never know.
You say it was inevitable that some quacks would just take good ideas like drinking water, you know, or cleaning wounds and push it to an excess. And there are a number of these stories. There's a kind of modern one. I mean, most of the stories come from fairly long ago, but this was from the 1990s. There was a somebody who recommended drinking a lot of water.
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, there's challenges and terrible things out there about people thinking like, oh, you know what, drinking water regularly is a good thing. Let's push it to extremes. Mm-hmm. If I drink more, it must be better, right? And that is incredibly dangerous. People who drink just plain water in large quantities in a short amount of time can die from something called hyponatremia, which is a dangerous lowering of your blood sodium level. And it's been seen. People die from that. And so, again, it's, you know, these ideas that come about from, you know, let's take this water idea and kind of go with it. And it gets pushed into some really dangerous areas sometimes, even though they may have come from really good intentions.
Yeah. There's this period of time, the natural hygiene movement that you write about. And some of this stuff seems to make some sense. And it's even you hear versions of it today, just go on a YouTube channel and you'll see all of this stuff, but and then it gets ridiculous. But let's talk a little bit about this I'm not even sure how you pronounce it. Breatharianism, is that?
Oh yeah. Breatharianism.
Breatharianism, yeah. This is from the 1980s. This is not that long ago.
Yeah, I actually saw breatharianism, I think, just ran across my Facebook page about someone claims that they are living on light and sun.
Yeah.
And I said, but that's a whole crock of... So, right. But what I didn't realize was that the concept actually comes from the ancient roots of Ayurvedic medicine, the sort of idea that there's this universal life force in all living things, and you might be able to use this force as a generator of energy, such as, you know, sunbathing and sunlight. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, people have taken this idea as meaning, you know, they really don't need anything but sunlight and air, and that's not physically possible. I think one of the most famous people who actually touted that they were a breatharian was this guy, Wiley Brooks.
Yeah.
I think this is from the 1980s. Do you guys remember that show, That's Incredible?
Sure, I
do. I remember watching that when I was a kid. So apparently he went on that show and said, yeah, all I need is air and light and I'm fine. And I think somebody actually caught him like sneaking into a 7-Eleven and eating Slurpees and Twinkies.
Yeah. He was way into quarter pounders with cheese at McDonald's or something. Like that. He was a junk food guy. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you can call that air and sunlight if you want to take that metaphor a little too far, but yeah.
I guess it's no surprise that since cancer has baffled medical science for centuries, there have been a lot of quack cures. Let's talk a little bit about that finally, because this seems really sad to me. This is one of those things where you take vulnerable people who are baffled about what to do, and some people who exploit this nonsense.
Yeah, and that's I think that's one of the saddest things about quackery in general is that there is this there's a sort of vulture-like, you know, taking advantage of people who really are looking for help, and they are desperate, and they are unhappy, and they're suffering, and it just means that they're, with that kind of amount of hope, they're just ripe for the taking. And it happens all the time. And there, in no other, you know, disease is it particularly, you know, awful than in cancer therapies. So this will probably go on for a long period of time because we don't have a perfect cure for cancer for all different cancers. We have lots of great cures, but not everyone. And, and people will look for anything to help. And this has been going on since, you know, the second century, you know, CE. You know, people said if you burn crabs and smear their ashes on your tumors, it'll make them go away. And
is really gross. That someone suggested holding a freshly killed rabbit or puppy or kitten.
Yes. Oh, it's so sad. So the idea was that this cancer is like this ravenous wolf in your body, and it's consuming you.
Yeah.
Right. And it makes sense. You know, a lot of people who suffer from, you know, a malignancy will waste a little bit. You'll notice they get thinner and their appetite goes away, and it's almost as if the cancer is eating them alive. And and people recognized this centuries ago, and they said, oh, it's this ravenous wolf. And if you can put something against your body, the tumor will feed off of that, like a lamb or a freshly killed rabbit instead of you. And, you know, of course, it probably didn't work. But they were willing to try anything back then, and people are still willing to try anything now.
Yeah. One of them was this this grape cure. Johanna Brandt was her name. And she said, fast for a few days, then use some enemas, and then eat 7 meals of grapes every day for 2 weeks. And that somehow is going to cure your cancer.
Yeah, and it wasn't just eating grapes. It was like enemas, grape juice enemas, and grape juice douches, and grape poultices, and gargles, and all these things. And, you know, the American Cancer Society, I think, had its hands full trying to debunk this over and over and over again, which it had to do. But, you know, despite that, I think there are still some people who think that it might work, unfortunately.
Well, it kind of gets us to something I wanted to ask you finally, because it's nice to know that, as you point out, we no longer live in these, as you put it, helpless eras where you just ate a bunch of grapes and hoped for the best. But you say early on in the book that this is just a brief history of these worst ways to cure everything, you know. Mm-hmm. But you say there are probably worst ways yet to come. We're not through with this silliness, I guess.
No, I don't think so. And I think that part of it is because, you know, our understanding of the human body, as good as it is today, there's still a lot we don't understand. There's still a lot of diseases we don't have cures for. I mean, look at the common cold. Mm-hmm. Look at things like, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome. I mean, there are things we don't fully understand. We can't cure well, and cancers. You know, so as long as we don't have great cures for them and ones that are freely available at a reasonable cost to everybody, people are going to look for other ways to treat these things. And on top of that, you know, as long as people have that sort of vibrant, burning interest in their health and getting healthy and trying to prolong their longevity as long as possible and beautify themselves, as long as that sort of fierce desire to do and change and maintain the human body exists, people are always going to be looking for these things. They're going to look for something a little bit better, a little bit easier, a little bit cheaper maybe, or a little bit foolproof. But that search is never going to go away.
Lydia King, her book is called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Claire Jones. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.